Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2004, at the end of a NATO summit in Istanbul, President George W. Bush hailed Turkey as a successful model for the Middle East. He said, quote, "Your country, with 150 years of democratic and social reforms, stands as a model to others and as Europe's bridge to the wider world. Your success is vital to a future of progress and peace in Europe and the broader Middle East," end quote. And it wasn't just George W. Bush that was hailing the successes of the Turkish model. As recently as 5 years ago, media outlets and U.S. pundits were asking whether this model of fusing Islam with capitalism and democracy can be replicated in other parts of the Middle East. The excitement about the Turkish model peaked during the Arab revolts of 2011. But today, the notion of Turkey as a model country is passé. Many are now asking, how did Turkey's President Erdogan manage to ruin the Turkish model? In his new book, The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism, today's guest, UC Berkeley sociologist Jihan Twal, writes, since the violent suppression of the protests during the summer of 2013, global circles have been perturbed by the following questions. What happened to Erdogan's liberalizing political party, which has brought so many freedoms to the country? Are liberal Muslims becoming more conservative? These worries are perhaps justified, but he says the questions are not asked in the right way. Jihan Twal argues that the successful liberalization in Turkey during the last three decades paved the way for Islam's later authoritarian and conservative incarnations. Jihan Twal is Associate Professor of Sociology at UC Berkeley. He's author of Passive Revolution, Absorbing the Islamic Challenge to Capitalism, and his latest book is called The Fall of the Turkish Model. And he joins us from the studios of UC Berkeley School of Journalism. Hi, Jihan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. Your book is packed with so much information. Before diving in and talking about the arguments you make, I want to talk about the current situation in Turkey. Almost every week, there are arrests and intimidation of activists, journalists, academics. The government has intensified its war on the Kurdish population in southeastern Turkey. But this doesn't get that much attention in the U.S. media unless you really look for it. So can you give us a sense of what the political climate is like in Turkey today?
Yeah, I would also include the European press in this too. So the European press, as well as the American liberal press, pays attention to certain misdeeds in Turkey, but not the suppression of Kurds. And actually, the threats against the academics and the suppression of the academics also happened as an outcome of the repression of Kurds. Some academics circulated a petition calling for a ceasefire with the Kurds. And it was after that that the government started to crack down on academics. What's happening in the Kurdish areas is just unbelievable when you look at it from the perspective of the last 10 years when relations were more peaceful. But actually, if you look at the last 150 years, there are many precedents for this, especially the civil war from 1993 to 1995, when villages were forcefully evacuated. And now the same thing is happening in Kurdish towns. So the Turkish state basically decimated the Kurdish countryside, cut off their sources of livelihood, as a result of which the Kurds flocked to towns both in the east and the west of the country. So now in Istanbul, Mersin, Adana, Izmir, Ankara, there are millions of Kurds. But the same situation holds for Kurdish towns themselves. They have become overpopulated, and ultimately they have become the new ground of activism and militancy for the Kurdish movement, and this includes civic mobilization as well as violent mobilization, which sometimes Kurds call self-defense. And the Turks, as well as the Turkish regime, as well as the American government, defines the situation, defines the Kurdish movement in Turkey as a terrorist movement. Mm. And there's a violent crackdown now in Kurdish towns.
Now, Turkey is comprised of almost 80 million people. What is the Kurdish population in Turkey?
Estimates vary between 15 million and 20 million.
15 million and 20 million. And can you tell us a little bit more about the crackdown on activists and journalists in Turkey?
Well, the crackdown on journalists started before the crackdown on academics, and it's more multidimensional, I should say, from the get-go. I mean, it's apparently more dimensional. The crackdown on academics is also multidimensional, but people focus in on the Kurdish dimension. What's happening with the journalists is that any serious journalist who criticizes the government is branded as a national security threat. And first they are fired from their mainstream papers. They start to write in blogs and electronic media, and some of them are ultimately arrested. And so there has been a crackdown going on for the last couple of years.
And what is the current state of the media in Turkey?
Well, more and more monopolized by the government. So the scene before 2013 was that the government had monopolized one half of the mainstream media, but the other half was controlled by old regime secular forces. And now this part of the media is also being slowly colonized and monopolized by the government. And even when it is not colonized and monopolized by the government, it is very subservient to the government.
The Guardian had a piece last month about two Turkish journalists facing multiple life sentences over their Syria reporting. The piece by, actually, it's Agence France-Presse at the Guardian website. Turkish prosecutors are seeking multiple life sentences for two journalists on charges of revealing state secrets in a report that alleged Erdogan's government tried to send arms into Syria.
Yes, exactly. And these are two of the most well-known journalists in Turkey, really established mainstream figures. So, you know, these are not maverick journalists or anything like that. But they had been writing in this secular mainstream for a while. And, of course, state secrets is a misnomer, because the whole world knows that Turkey is arming ISIS. So this is not a secret at all. They just uncovered some documents, but it wasn't anything big, actually, because the documents of similar tone were circulating throughout the mainstream global press even. So everybody knew this, but somebody had to be targeted. So they were just unlucky.
And so you think they're doing this to send a message to other journalists?
Yes, definitely. I mean, this is just part of a broader crackdown. It's not just against those two people. It's really a way to scare the hell out of everybody else, including citizens, but of course, first and foremost, opposition journalists and secular journalists.
And Cihan, before we dive in and talk about your book and the Turkish model that was embraced by so many in the West, what else do you think we need to know about Turkey? Because it just doesn't get that much attention in the U.S. press, and as you said, the European press, unless you really look for it.
Yes. There are many things that can be said. Perhaps to put this in broader historical perspective, we need to remember that Turkey is a successor of the Ottoman Empire, an empire which broke down in a quite violent fashion, as all other empires break down. And afterwards, things became a little stabilized, but the recent flaring of the Kurdish issue in the last 30 years should be seen as a belated aftermath of that breakup of empire. And the northern Kurdistan is sort of the only non-Turkish, predominantly non-Turkish place that Turkey is holding. And this is, you know, like a belated breakup of the last piece of empire.
So let's dive in and talk about your book, Jihan, The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism. You argue that if you look at neocons and liberals, the one thing that they disagreed, obviously, on a range of burning issues, but they united in their embrace of what they called the Turkish model. Can you explain this? What is this, the Turkish model, which infuses Islam with capitalism and democracy?
Of course, the way it was talked about it in the mainstream press emphasized Islam and democracy more than capitalism. So it was maybe in The Economist and more policy-oriented and policy audience-oriented magazines and journals that the capitalism and neoliberalism issues were more emphasized. But for the broader public, what Turkey stood for was the marriage of democracy and Islam, and that was held as an alternative to Iran and 9/11, basically. And occasionally Saudi Arabia and the Gulf too, but that didn't go very far. So what was most emphasized in the mainstream media was how the Turkish marriage of Islam and democracy constituted an alternative to Iran. And we can't call that exactly a model, but 9/11 and what Al-Qaeda promised to other Muslims. So the world wanted to see, when I say the world, I really mean the West. Mm-hmm. The West wanted to see most Muslims following Turkey instead of Iran and Al-Qaeda, and that was why it was propped up.
And so I'd like you to elaborate on those two, but first, you write that in the Turkish model, it was Islamic liberalism, a marriage of formal democracy, free market capitalism, and a toned-down conservative Islam. Can you explain what you mean by that? Because these days, the word Islam is just thrown around. What do you mean by a toned-down conservative Islam?
Okay, when you put it like that, you know, free market democracy, formal democracy plus toned down conservative of Islam, that's my framing more than the mainstream's framing. And what I mean by that is, for example, just to take something very tangible and simple, the headscarf is okay, we should understand, you know, the Western mainstream press was saying. The headscarf is okay, it can go together with the free market, and it can go with our understanding of democracy when it becomes a part of fashion, for example. So the subordination of women, Islamic clothing, were reframed as okay and not as dangerous as the Iranian or Al-Qaeda versions, because they could go together with, you know, this fashionable covering, could go together with the kind of democracy that the West thought was appropriate to Muslims, and free market capitalism spreading in the Middle East and in the Muslim world.
And talk a little bit more about how this concept came about, because as you said, it was embraced by neocons, liberals, national, international journalists, academics, and think tanks. So it was really embraced by a wide range of people and organizations.
Yes, exactly. And that's why it was really, really difficult to write anything critical of this during the 2000s. And now everybody's criticizing Turkey. But in the 2000s, there was such a broad consensus that Turkey was in the right direction that anybody attacking or even mildly criticizing this consensus was perceived to be half insane almost. And how did this come about? It wasn't overnight. So it started in the late 1970s, I should say, with the rise of Islamist movements themselves throughout the region and beyond. So in Pakistan, Indonesia too, not just the Middle East, but Iran, Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, there were Islamist movements everywhere. And at the same time, there were leftist movements. So as early as the 1960s and 1970s, the conservative and liberal global mainstream, so Western capitalism, started to think that even though this could be risky, the Islamists could be supported against the leftists. Now, the Iranian Revolution really made things a little more complicated because the Iranian Revolution was almost, or perhaps occasionally more, anti-Western capitalist than the leftist movements in this region. But Turkey was home to these Islamic movements that were both anti-leftist and anti-Iranian and anti-revolutionary Islam. So a lot of pundits, policymakers started to look at Turkey and whether the Islamist movement in Turkey could move in a desirable direction. However, the mainstream, or I shouldn't say the mainstream, but the most popular Islamic movement of the 1980s and 1990s, back then known as the Welfare Party, was as anti-Western as anti-Iranian. So it was also perceived as a threat, but there was another very large Islamic Sufi or Neo-Sufi or post-Sufi community known by the name of Fethullah Gülen community or Gülen community, which was much more pro-Western, definitely pro-neoliberal, even pro-Israel, that was perceived as an ally. And what happened after 9/11, due to several reasons that we can later go into, is that these two strands of the Islamist movement in Turkey converged. The Gulenists started to think more and more like the Welfare Party, and the old Welfare Party personnel that split from the Welfare Party started to think more like the Gulenists. So they didn't become pro-Israel, but they became more pro-Western, more pro-neoliberal, and toned down their conservatism. So they became more comfortable with these expressions of piety, such as fashionable Islamic clothing, fashionable covering that could be integrated into liberal democracy. So that after that merger of the two sides, two faces of the Islamist movement in Turkey, more and more people, Turkish academics and journalists, as well as Western policymakers and journalists and academics, started to say, aha, you know, this is the best deal possible. These people can credibly claim they're good Muslims. So it's not, you know, this old secular Turkey fighting against the Islamist movements and Iran and Al-Qaeda, but these are practicing, pious, sincere Muslims who want to be allies with the West, who want to join the European Union, and at least can work with Israel, even if they don't love Israel, and they are definitely pro-free market. So the new Islamism in Turkey in the 2000s fit very well with what came to be called the Washington Consensus in the 1980s and later the post-Washington Consensus in the 1990s, which meant free markets, a little bit of religion, and this is not just Islam, but Christianity for the Christian world. So free markets, a little bit of religion, and formal democracy.
Today I'm speaking with UC Berkeley sociologist Cihan Tual about his new book, The Fall of the Turkish Model. He writes that 5 years ago, the West, including the neocons and many liberals, hailed Turkey as a viable model for fusing Islam with capitalism and democracy. But he argues that flaws with this model are inherent in the very model of Islamic liberalism. So if you have any questions for Cihan, we'd love to hear from you. Questions overall about Turkey. If you're from Turkey, what are your thoughts on the changes that you have seen over the past 5-10 years? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Cihan, when you look at this Turkish model, what did it mean inside Turkey? And inside Turkey, who really embraced this concept?
Again, it was a very broad coalition, I should say. So obviously, the most Islamists themselves, even though those who wanted to stick to a more anti-liberal, anti-free market Islam, were initially dropped off from the coalition. They were to be later integrated close to 2010, and we can later come to that. So that's the obvious part. But who else? Well, a lot of right-wing nationalists who were sort of toning down their authoritarianism and totalitarianism in the 1980s and 1990s, who were liberalizing themselves, also joined this new party. But more interestingly, the embrace came from liberal academics, liberal journalists, and one wing of the secular business class, the more liberal, the more pro-American wing of the business class, and the new middle class that had been created by the neoliberal reforms, economic as well as political reforms of the 1980s and 1990s. And even though these people were mostly secular, they saw in this party a new promise for social peace. So Islamists had been criticizing Turkey's Western direction for decades, and now there was this new Islamism they could work with. So broad sectors of the population, including conservatives, seculars, liberals, they all embraced the party because of this new promise. But we should also look at those who did not like this new package.
So who didn't like it?
Yeah, so the most fierce critics were old-style secularists. So the people who wanted to stick to the model of the 1930s secularism, you know, Islamists have to be excluded, Islamic clothing, whether fashionable or not, we don't care. They have no place in the universities, they have no place in the workplaces. So anybody who covers her hair is a potential threat, not necessarily a security threat, but bringing religion into the public sphere was perceived as undermining Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's reforms. So the old style secularists remained mobilized throughout the 2000s. So there were big street demonstrations drawing in as many as 3 million people throughout the country. So no one single demonstration counted 3 million, but when you combine all of the numbers, it was in the millions, really. So these were really strong and mostly an older generation. So not many young people participated in these protests. So that remained the strongest opposition in the 2000s.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, there were many other sections in the population, but they were less powerful. So organized labor, which had lost out to neoliberal free market reforms for three decades, organized labor remained opposed, but nobody really cared for organized labor, either within the Turkish mainstream or among Turkey's supporters in the West. So that remained a very silent opposition. And the same thing with the environmentalist critiques of neoliberalism. They remained very invisible up until the 2013 protests known as the Gezi protests. And a sizable but powerless population, the heterodox Muslim Alevis, who are an offshoot of Shia Islam but are very different from Syrian Alawites and Iran Shia Muslims. They remained very much opposed to this new so-called democratic Islam, which they did not experience as democratic. I mean, they perceived it as the Sunnification of Turkey. So they remained very much opposed.
Well, after the break, we'll talk more about the protests. And also, I'd love to hear more from you about what the status is of organized labor today. We're talking with UC Berkeley sociologist Cihan Tual about his new book, The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism. This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation this morning on Your Call on the telephone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255. Coming up in a half hour, it's BBC's World Have Your Say. Amongst other things, they'll be looking at Donald Trump's many victories in America's primaries and caucuses. Half hour from now at 11 o'clock, BBC World Have Your Say.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution. In the late 60s, DuPont's own researchers knew that the chemical it used to develop Teflon was toxic and posed serious health risks. But the chemical giant kept that information confidential while still profiting. Today, that Teflon toxin is in almost all of our bodies. So what is being done to hold DuPont accountable and regulate chemicals to protect public safety? That's tomorrow. Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are joined by UC Berkeley sociologist Cihan Tual. We're discussing his new book, The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism. In his book, he writes, what was the Turkish model? Well, in two words, it was Islamic liberalism, and it was embraced by everyone from American neocons to liberals. So we're talking about what happened, who embraced this, and then, as his book says, the fall of the Turkish model, what happened. You can give us a call if you have any questions for Cihan, if you're from Turkey or the Middle East and you'd like to talk about the changes you've seen over the past 5 years. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Also, if you have any questions about the role of Turkey in the Syria crisis, we'd love to hear from you. We'll spend some more time on that. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. I just like to give you a different perspective from what is really going on in the Middle East. Well, Erdogan is a Muslim Brotherhood guy. You know, he is. And the whole Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East got tainted. The people themselves, they think they are, you know, good Muslim Brotherhood. But I think they got infiltrated by the new conservative whole thing of regime changes, you know, destroying the Middle East under the name of the world democracy. You heard today Al-Sisi admitting for the first time that the Russian plane was downed by a bomb, which all of us knew that for a long time, for a few months. But the fact is, who would get damaged by this action? Sure, in the Egyptian, big, huge number of Egyptians rely on tourists, which would be damaged. So these guys with the plane, which supposedly part of this Daesh, I never call them ISIS, bunch of criminals, bloody barbarians. The little guys, they think doing something in Islam. Islam doesn't tell you to do that. But the leaders, all of the leaders are Asian, paid agents, in fact, for the new cons, for the American military industrial complex. Mm-hmm. Look what they did in Libya. Look what they did in Syria. It is terrible. Forget about Islam. Right now, the word democracy in the Middle East is dirty word, bloody word, is used to screw all of the people in the Middle East, just continue the robbery that happened since the British and the French did in the early century. Let us forget, Erdogan is a traitor. All of this, Daesh barbarians should be wiped out of the face of Earth. The only people really fighting Daesh are the Egyptians and the Russians. Americans are today supplying with money and arms.
Well, Eid, thank you for your call. You brought up a number of points. First off, Cihan, would you talk about the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, yes, it's actually a very important part of my book. The Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, is kind of the mother of all modern Islamist movements. Of course, there are other Islamic movement traditions, but when we talk about Islamism rather than just Islamic movements, we mean a comprehensive vision of Islam that claims that there's a separate Islamic economy, separate Islamic model for the polity that should be distinguished from both socialism and capitalism, from both liberalism and communism. So that vision was first put into political practice in Egypt by the Muslim Brotherhood. And then there were many offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the globe, but the Egyptian one really remained the strongest, most popular one, and it influenced the Turkish Welfare Party, so the Islamists before the Justice and Development Party in Turkey. So it was hugely influential, even on non-Muslim Brotherhood figures throughout the Islamic world. Now, when we put the Muslim Brotherhood in the center, we also understand, we also start to perceive that there have been huge changes, transformations within Islamist movements themselves, because the Muslim Brotherhood was like the almost the only model up until the 1990s, well, I should say 1970s, up for the Sunni world, though, for those who wanted to stick to Sunni Islamism, up until the 1990s, they remained the main model. But then the Iranian Revolution and the rise of Al-Qaeda and ultimately liberal Islam in Turkey started to put down different paths, alternative paths that started to compete with the vision of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood itself started to question its own allegiance to anti-capitalism, especially following the 1960s, due to several reasons I cover in the book. I won't go into detail here. But what happened as an aftermath of that questioning was that the Muslim Brotherhood itself became more and more liberalized, democratized, and started to resemble the Justice and Development Party. However, there were serious cultural and political limits, and this process never went very far. So the Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, never became as liberal and as democratic as the Turkish Justice and Development Party. Now, I won't go into all of the reasons here because they are really complex, and some of them are Egypt-specific, some of them are not. But what concerns us here is when the Arab revolts happened in 2011, the Western pundits and policymakers thought, aha, you know, this is the perfect moment. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood can move beyond its internal splits and really imitate the Justice and Development Party and become the government in Egypt, and the new regime in Egypt, post-Mubarak regime in Egypt, could be modeled after the Turkish Justice and Development Party. And that was tried, and it failed. The non-liberals within the Muslim Brotherhood remained in control. And Erdogan and his party very forcefully and publicly tried to push the Muslim Brotherhood into a Turkish direction. They said, you know, you have to defend a secular state. A secular state can go with Islamic liberalism. Don't worry, it can go together with conservative Islam. It can go together with piety and good Islamic practice. And the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood simply said, no, we don't want any of that. And I'm not talking about the whole Islam Muslim Brotherhood, but the people who were in control between 2011 and 2013 did not like this message. And they basically said, okay, we are going to follow your economic model, and we are going to welcome Turkish businesses. You know, we can exploit Egyptian labor and Egyptian markets together. That's fine with us. But don't give us any of your secularism, whether it's Islamized or conservative. We don't care. We are not going to defend a secular state. They said we're going to defend a civil state, whatever that means. And, you know, the debate is inconclusive within Egypt what that means. But it was a stand-in for some version of an Islamic state that wouldn't look like Saudi Arabia and Iran, that would be less conservative.
Well, and to that point, we often hear that Islam is not compatible with democracy. How do you approach that view?
Well, I think, and this is one of the major arguments of the book, so I try to show that Islam is compatible with democracy, but this is not the interesting question to ask. This is not the major issue in the Middle East. The major issue is Islam Is democracy compatible with these trends of neoliberalization that we have been seeing ever since the 1970s? And they first seem to, the neoliberal trends first seem to promote democratization, but they create all the dynamics that will undermine democratization. And when regimes and societies move in a democratic direction, I argue, Islamic actors will also, some Islamic actors will reinterpret Islam to fit the new trends. And they have done so in the cases of Turkey and secondarily Egypt and Tunisia. But when neoliberalization and democratization started to undermine each other, Islamic actors also started to take on non-democratic practices. So the main question is not whether Islam and democracy can go together. Yeah, they can, but that's not the issue. The issue is how is the Middle East going to become democratic despite neoliberalism?
UC Berkeley sociologist Cihan Tual is author of The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Let's go next to Dan in Berkeley. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. I want to again raise the question why the West continues under Barack Obama, just as it had under George W. Bush, fall for the notion that just because a society votes democratically that it's going to become an open and free society. We've seen manifestations of this in Iraq, Afghanistan, and certainly in the Palestinian territories. Hamas is, according to the Pew poll, the most popular force there, and indeed, Pew poll and the polls taken by various Islamic societies themselves underscore that a majority of Muslims support Sharia law, which is antithetical to democracy. And I'm wondering if the professor could speak about this.
Cihan?
Oh yes. The major reason why the West under Bush or Obama or Jack Straw or Blair or anybody else was supporting these movements and regimes was not primarily because they were democratic, but because they were perceived to be compatible with Western interests. Now, that's the regime dimension, you know, why American and British regimes were supporting these movements and regimes. But the more interesting dilemmas we find in the mainstream press. For example, the New York Times is a very good example here. The New York Times was much more divided, internally conflicted in its approach to these movements and regimes. They were more aware of the non-democratic trends and non-democratic tendencies of the Muslim Brotherhood, of the Turkish Justice and Development Party, but they still believed that both the Western press, Western public opinion, as well as the Western regimes could push these regimes and movements in the Middle East in a more democratic direction. So it's not simply that New York Times or even Obama's policy experts ignored that there are non-democratic tendencies in these movements and regimes. But the belief was that, okay, if we play it right, they will become more democratic. So it's not that they are democratic from the beginning, but if we play it right, they're going to become more democratic. So that was the belief.
All right. Well, thank you for the phone call. Let's go next to TJ in Santa Clara. Hi, TJ. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to, come back like the last caller regarding the reconciliation of democracy and Islam and your guest statement regarding interpretation of Islam. And part of that ability to interpret, I would say, is the concept of ijtihad, which I understand is considered closed among Sunnis, and that we're seeing, to the extent there is democracy, it seems to be among the religious minorities, even the Shias, but also the Alawites, and I guess you look at Indonesia and Malaysia. And I would say, can you comment on what is the role of ijtihad in Islam currently? Am I incorrect in thinking that it's considered closed among Sunnis?
Well, no longer. The doors of Ijtihad were closed after the 10th century in the Christian calendar. But ever since the 19th century, more and more clerics have started to declare the doors of Ijtihad are open. So Islam can be reinterpreted. And the difference from the Christian tradition here is perhaps the notion that the literal word of the Quran has been unaltered. So that's the mainstream Muslim beliefs among, you know, most Muslims. So even the proponents of Ijtihad do not believe that, you know, we can drop a certain verse and forget about it. But what has been changing in the last 200 years is that there are more and more clerics and non-clerics, so many intellectuals, many non-clerical intellectuals, who think that the interpretation, reinterpretation of many verses is possible. And in this regard, the Turkish version of liberal Islam is not completely new. What is novel about it is that this has become regime policy in the 2000s. But when it comes to liberal Islam as an intellectual and clerical trend, it has existed for more than 150 years, counting in many of the most prominent clerics and theologians of the 20th century, such as the Pakistani Fazlur Rahman, who became sort of like the guru of the Turkish regime and the Turkish clerics and theologians in the 2000s.
Thank you for calling in, TJ. Today we are joined by UC Berkeley sociologist Cihan Tual, and he's talking about his new book, The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from Dory in San Francisco. Hi, Dory. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. And Cihan, I have a few points that are very different from each other, so just pick whatever you want and comment on them. One is that referring, I'm not saying that you did, but I'm saying for people to refer to a Turkey as a democracy just makes a sham of the word democracy. There's no freedom of speech. You already have spoken about that. Opposition political parties cannot even safely assemble or campaign, as we saw with the HDP party and the bombings that took place. Secondly, you know, in 2012 and 2013, I think the Committee to Protect Journalists said that Turkey had the most journalists in prison. These were mostly Kurdish journalists. Right now, I think they rank 149th among 180 countries. Another thing I wanted to bring up was, if you want to comment on the fact that in the ever-evolving nightmare in Syria, right now, with Erdogan, you know, saber-rattling that he may put ground troops into northern Syria, and always, for the last, like, week and a half, shelling northern Syria, where the Kurds are, the possibility of a confrontation between Russia and Turkey. And the other thing is what you were talking about earlier about the petition of the academics and the fact that Erdogan is trying to remove the founding principle of secularism in education and come up with more of a religious generation by having an Islamist curriculum in the schools, and by suspending and firing these academics, he's putting in people that are much more likely to teach the Islamist curriculum. So those are just some of the things I wanted to bring up.
All right, thank you for that, Dory. What about that, Cihan?
Yeah, thanks for the informed comment. You know, I would agree with all of the specifics. I just have a different way of looking at it, but we completely agree on the specifics and how these endanger the very safety of the citizens in Turkey, and not just the Kurds, but even the Turks themselves. Now, why do I call this democracy? Other people, obviously, you know, also call it democracy. But why would I call this democracy after all of these criticisms and my agreements with them? Well, first of all, I call this liberal democracy, not just democracy. And what do I mean by that? Liberal democracy is usually used as a very positive concept, but not in my vocabulary, I should admit. Liberal democracy for me is the combination of two contradictory elements. Democracy is the empowerment of the people, and liberalism, not understood in the American sense of liberalism of the, you know, liberal wing of the Democratic Party, but in the more classical sense of, you know, John Locke and John Stuart Mill, is putting the individual and his or her happiness and property in the center. And these are two contradictory elements. I'm not saying they can't go together. Obviously, they have gone together in the U.S. For, you know, at least 150 years after the Jacksonian years, they have gone together. But in weaker societies, in structurally weaker societies, these two elements of liberal democracy, popular empowerment and the property and the happiness of the individual, which ultimately comes to mean the more powerful individuals, they contradict in unsustainable ways. So they also contradict in American history too. But then the contradictions and the problems are minor, and the Red Scare can be put down easily. The McCarthyism doesn't get out of hand. It just puts down communists and their sympathizers. But the problem in structurally weaker societies is that there are too many contradictions between these two principles within liberal democracy, and that's why liberal democracy can never become too democratic. So that was partially the problem with introducing both liberalization and democratization at the same time in these societies ever since the 1970s, and then during the Arab Spring, when you have striking workers blocking the streets all the time, you cannot really practice liberalism and liberal democracy. These are violently put down in Egypt. These are violently put down in Turkey in 2011, 2012. And the ongoing repression in Turkey is very well demonstrative of that. And there are so many people out on the streets that you cannot sustain liberal democracy as democratic in these countries. And I know that's a very general statement, and as I have pointed out in the very beginning, there are also specificities unique to Turkey, such as the Kurdish question. Turkey being this empire that still has not completely broken up, and that is one reason why there are so many journalists in prison. Anybody raising eyebrows against the regime regarding its handling of the Kurds is in big danger in Turkey. So there are these general as well as specific reasons why Turkish liberal democracy has never been too democratic and will never be too democratic.
Well, thank you for calling in, Dory. And so many people are interested in this issue, Jihan. We have full lines, but we don't have much time. So let's try to get to maybe two more. Let's go to Mark in Redwood City. Hi, Mark.
I lived in Germany from 75 to 81, and I traveled extensively in Turkey in 1980, 81, for like 4 months or so. And my impression was at that time, in the German press and everything, that Turkey was craving to get into the common market and to be integrated into Europe, and they were just wholeheartedly rejected, primarily by the Germans that had were very scared of their very large Turkish population. And I'm wondering if it is really accurate to not go back further to find out the roots of these problems, because if Germany had been more receptive to allowing Turkey to join the common market and be fully integrated into Europe, I don't think there'd be anything there now but a liberal democratic government. Comments?
Well, yes, I agree. The EU has definitely made things worse for Turkey, but it's really a two-way street. So EU has been largely hypocritical in its dealings with Turkey, so it expected much less from other countries in the Balkans regarding their democratic credentials, and the bar for Turkey was set very high from the beginning, partially in order to exclude Turkey and partially in order due to the fear that these 70-80 million Turks would somehow wreck European democracy. It's another discussion whether the fear is justified or not, but it's definitely led to hypocrisy. But we should never forget that the Turkish regimes were never that willing to become as democratic as the Western European countries, and especially in their dealing with the Kurds and secondarily with the lesser challenges such as environmentalists and organized labor. So, yes, the EU was extremely hypocritical, but it was a two-way street.
And, Cihan, we only have a minute left. At the end of your book, you write, the Turkish model as we know it is on its way out. The Iranian model has become a weak shadow of itself and does not promise much to the region. We are heading toward a void. So what's next?
Well, I completed this book a while ago. The production process took a little longer than I expected. When I completed the book, ISIS was not as strong. And the answer to the question, what next, is very obvious now. It is ISIS. So after liberal Islam and revolutionary Islam are dead, what you get is not an Al-Qaeda model, which didn't exist, but the statization of the Al-Qaeda model, which is ISIS. And the whole world is combining, and still they're unable to defeat ISIS in Syria, and ISIS is getting entrenched in Libya. So the death of liberal Islam is not going to have nice ramifications in the region.
Well, we should have you back to have a discussion about ISIS. This show got a lot of attention. Thank you all for your emails and phone calls. Sorry I didn't get to all of you. Cihan Tual is UC Berkeley sociologist and author of the book, The Fall of the Turkish Model, How the Arab Uprisings Brought Down Islamic Liberalism. Cihan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution. In the late 60s, DuPont's own researchers knew that C8, the chemical it used to develop Teflon, was toxic and posed serious health risks. The chemical giant kept its research confidential while profiting from C8. Today, the Teflon toxin is in the bloodstream of almost all Americans. So what's being done to hold DuPont accountable and regulate chemicals to protect public safety? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.